Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. I'm ever yours, Alan Nathan, the militant moderate. President Obama warning his own party members not to be inflexible in their debt ceiling negotiations with Republicans. Also, CNN and other outlets are reporting a 58% drop in border arrests, apparently in part due to state bills cracking down on illegal immigrants. Apparently, it's been having a chilling impact on those considering crossing over the border. And who is the most viable GOP challenger to President Obama in 2012? By the way, before I move on, we were talking a little earlier with Jack Warren, president of FMX Entertainment, which again produces the Nashville Music Minute. For folks wanting to know a little bit more about that, please feel free to visit that website, NashvilleMusicMinute.com. Again, NashvilleMusicMinute.com. Assisting me right now in the Opani Department, old friend of the show, Mark Levine, my regular for this part of the hour and this part of the week, a former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. radio host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. You want to learn more about Mark? Well, forget about it. He's not worth knowing. No, just kidding. Go to www.marklevineradio.com. Again, marklevineradio.com. That's M-A-R-K-L-E-V-I-N-E, radio.com. Mark, good to have you back, buddy.
Thanks, Alan.
Listen, I was talking with Tony Blankley about this, so I'm kind of curious about what you have to say. Obama was telling his party leadership just yesterday that if they draw hard lines in the sand, not only would it be harder to negotiate with the Republicans, but it would also negatively impact the financial markets. Do you think he has a point?
Well, yeah, you know, it was interesting. I read that same article that you read in the Washington Post. In the C section, the style section, it was talking about how to talk a man off the top of a ledge so that he doesn't jump off. And it was comparing that to the debt ceiling. It said, don't make promises that you can't keep. And it talked about how John Boehner said that he wouldn't let it pass unless he got certain things. And that puts him in a bind because everyone in the world knows that neither John Boehner nor President Obama nor any thinking person in America wants to see this nuclear just explosion to our economy. No one wants to see us fail to pay our debts because that would destroy the nation's economy. So it's a lot like dealing with a terrorist who's got a child as a hostage or someone about to jump off a building. You want to treat them carefully. At the same time, everybody knows that we're going to pass this debt ceiling. So the question is, how much can two people, both of them can blow up the nation's economy, how much are they willing to risk? And the scary thing is that they might go right to the edge, which really would harm financial markets.
You know, it's intriguing you should point that out, because as we've discussed, House Speaker John Boehner does have a few of his own lines in the sand. One, that the debt ceiling only be raised if there's $2 trillion in cuts, many of them to be implemented immediately. And number two, that there be no taxes raised, believing that our problem is that, you know, we spend too much and not that we pay too little. In your estimation, which party has the most leverage when it comes to this debate? The Republicans, who can use their ultimate authority not to raise the debt ceiling if they don't get their cuts, or the Democrats, who, by way of Obama's veto pen, could reject the bill that required those cuts, which, of course, would lead to the debt ceiling not getting raised by default? What's your assessment?
Well, the Democrats have more power because the American people want what the Democrats want, and they don't want what the Republicans want, which is why it was really stupid of John Boehner to say what he said. He's not going to keep his promise. He's going to have to back down, and that's going to make him look bad.
Yeah, but that kind
of
goes against something.
Neither party wants to push the nuclear button.
I've got to ask you to pause. I'm just going to ask you to pause real fast, because we have to remember that recently there was this NBC Wall Street Journal poll showing that after respondents were given the pros and cons of raising the debt ceiling, 62% of Americans came out against it.
Well, it just shows you they don't know what it means, because 78% of Americans don't want to cut Medicare. So the Republican solution to
are these mutually exclusive, though?
Medicare affects is the,
aren't these
lives.
Are these mutually exclusive? Your assertion assumes that they're mutually exclusive. That's a bit of a disconnected measure. Are you saying that there's no way we could move forward and just have a lot of spending cuts and still not touch Medicare?
Alan, as you well know, under Paul Ryan's bill, the debt ceiling has to be raised. There is, under Ron Paul's bill, there's not a single politician in the country that has a proposal that wouldn't require raising the debt ceiling. So if you want to cut our spending in half, you still have to raise the debt ceiling. If you want to end the military in America, you still have to raise the debt ceiling. So everyone knows it has to be done. So the question is, Will either party risk the entire economic collapse of our country for centuries to get their own way?
Well, that's what I mean by disconnected measures. This is the art of movable standards, wherein you rename a thing as being something other than what it is in order to gain the ground your arguments otherwise could not. You and I both know, and we have it on good authority, that while it would be problematic for us to not move forward with raising the debt ceiling, the monies coming in would immediately first go to our debt, ensuring that we don't violate the full faith and credit of the United States. Subsequent to that, though, we would then have to start reallocating the funds for the other programs, clearly ensuring that proportionately each gets one hell of a haircut. So while it might be, let me say this real fast, while it might potentially violate what a lot of people could reasonably assert is a covenant that we have with our fellow Americans, in that a lot of people would start being short shrifted, when it comes to whether or not the full faith and credit of the United States would be jeopardized, that is simply not the case, because our debts would be the first to get the revenues coming in.
Well, what the Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has said is that actually the debt ceiling runs out in May. It runs out this month.
But he can pay bills till August 12th.
He's going to scramble, and he's going to do exactly what you're talking about. First, you know, people will close down the national parks, and then they won't get their Social Security checks, and then we'll have to start, you know, laying off our military, not paying our military. And you're right, but it will take till August before we default on the national debt and have great economic collapse, assuming that the debt ceiling's not raised.
But you're asking the Republicans to walk away from using leverage that would be able to get for them a hell of a lot more cuts than they could ever secure if they first go along with raising the debt ceiling and then try to barter for cuts against the Democrats thereafter. But they've got the leverage right now. Yeah. And I got to tell you, my friend, I know they're going to use it. Now, I think they're going to raise the debt ceiling, but it's only going to be after they secure some pretty big cuts, cuts that seem to be quite necessary.
I think we need to let them save face. I agree that when you've got a terrorist and they've got a small child, you've got to give them some way to save face, some way to walk down off that ledge. You've got to remember, the Republicans raised the debt ceiling 5, 6, 7, 8 times, massively raised it during the Bush era. The Democrats who opposed all that massive Republican spending didn't say peep, didn't threaten to send the nation into economic collapse.
Except the president.
Armageddon.
Except the president.
Saying they should have.
Except the president. You realize that, except for the president. The president,
no, he was wrong.
When he was Senator Obama, he voted against raising the debt ceiling. Doesn't seem to be a man who practices what he preaches.
Well, he was wrong. He said he's wrong. I agree he's wrong. And he knew that it wouldn't keep it from passing. Because everyone knows at the end of the day, they've got to raise this. Here's the thing. If Congress spends so much money and they vote to spend so much money, why should the debt ceiling arbitrarily undo what Congress has already voted to do? It's an arbitrary measure that lets any branch of government destroy the U.S. economy. And it's a very big, blunt instrument.
What do you say, my friend, to those who say, great, then the Democrats have a perfect way of ensuring that this is not allowed to be. Go along with some severe spending cuts as being part and parcel of the raising of the debt ceiling.
Let's go further. Let's say the Republicans say that the only way we're going to not let the nation default is to require Obama to resign and Biden to resign and let the Speaker Boehner be.
More disconnected measures, not having the least infinitesimal correlative relevance to what I just stated. Look, we got to remember Standard & Poor's warning to the United States was that if it does not reduce our national debt of $14.3 trillion, we could lose our coveted status as the most secure economy. That's why they lowered our outlook status from stable to negative. You know, Britain got that same kind of wake-up call. Guess what? They made some austere changes, and it's now paying dividends, and their rating went back up. Maybe we should emulate what they've done.
This is the same set of employers that gave AAA rating to those junk bonds that were the credit derivative swap market, so I don't think anyone has faith in them.
Another disconnected measure. You know that if nobody really had any faith in what these people were saying, the Obama administration would not have worked so hard behind the scenes to get them to not do the very thing they did. Standards and Poor giving the warning. Stick with us. More with Mark. You are with Battleline, Main Street Radio Network. I'm Alan Nate. There's been some additional coverage of the whole issue of gun control. I guess to a degree it was sparked in the aftermath of the January 8th massacre in Tucson. But beyond that, we still have the old struggle. Now, there does appear to be in place a greater appreciation for the Second Amendment rights of American citizens. We have finally had some rulings from the Supreme Court that has finally unambiguously stated that this is an individual right, not a collective right. Mark Levine joins us, former congressional attorney and Washington, D.C. talk host on Pacifica Radio's WPFW. Always good to have you on. Mark, how are you again?
I'm good. I'm always glad to talk about the Constitution, my favorite topic.
Well, good. Then let's get right into it. For folks who need to get their arms around this, let me try to boil it down a little bit. Mark, you disabuse me, as I'm sure you will, with great dispatch and alacrity if I have this wrong. But at issue are really two dueling perspectives. The collective right to own firearms, which is contingent upon the existence of a militia, and the individual right, which is reliant only upon the citizen's independent preference. Now, let's take a look at the Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, there were two cases. One's called the Heller case that took place in D.C., and then another in Chicago. I think it was McDonald v. Chicago, if memory serves.
I think that's it. Yeah.
But they both came down. Now, the reason why they had to have the Chicago was because the Heller ruling essentially focused on an enclave of the government. So it couldn't necessarily be inferred as meaning, oh, it applies here, applies to all the states because it's an enclave of the government. But I think most people saw the writing on the wall. Once McDonald v. Chicago came around, because Chicago had a very similar restrictive gun ban in place, as was the case in D.C., I think the writing was on the wall, and people realized that the decision was pretty much going to be as it worked out, which was, of course, to be in concurrence with the Heller decision. So now, unambiguously, people have an individual right to keep and bear arms. And you're upset by this. You did not agree with either of these two decisions, did you?
No, I think they were logically wrong. I mean, one thing your listeners should understand, I know you understand this, Alan, but there's a difference between a constitutional standard and a state standard, right? You may absolutely, in fact, I don't believe in banning handguns, for example. I think you should use them for your own defense and get them licensed and all of that. But that's not the issue in this case. What I believe that states' rights should hold. In other words, if Montana was going to have wide-open gun laws, but Chicago and D.C. want to restrict guns or limit guns, let the people decide. Let the democracy decide.
Let me ask you to pause right there so people don't lose you. And I'm not interrupting. I want people to pause because this can sometimes get intricate. That's all. When you talk about that, though, some are going to say, wait a minute, hold it, Mark. The Bill of Rights is to transcend all that. It's to protect us.
That's right. If there's a constitutional standard, it transcends states' rights. You're absolutely right about that. So then the question is, how do you read the Second Amendment? All right. The Second Amendment says, as you read, a well-regulated militia may be necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Now, you forgot the next comma. Right. There's a comma after arms, but go ahead.
There's actually three commas. There's one after militia, too. But the heart of it is, and I know you like grammar, Alan. I do, too, because you look at these things intricately. It is what's called a dependent clause. It is the clause modifies it. Now, what the Supreme Court held is that the Second Amendment, by the way, for 200 years they held my way. Only recently in the last couple of years did they overturn 200 years of jurisprudence and find your way. And I think if we get rid of one justice, they'll turn it back. But what the Supreme Court is, in effect, saying is that the Second Amendment – the founders didn't mean what they wrote. They wrote that the right of the people, and by the way, anytime there's a collective right in the Constitution, it says the people. When there's an individual right, like the right to remain silent, it says persons, because persons is individuals, people is collective. But it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms is necessary because a well-regulated militia is necessary to secure you of a free state. So clearly, I believe that if you join a National Guard, that's a well-regulated militia, the Constitution can't stop you from doing that. That's what the Second Amendment is about. But it doesn't apply to individual rights. If it did, the Second Amendment would read differently. It would say, a well-regulated militia is necessary to secure a free state, period. The right of persons to keep and bear arms should not be infringed, period. That would be an individual right. That's not how it was written.
Well, I differ with you, as you might not be surprised, because I'm thinking inarguably a militia is an on-call citizen's army. And right. if needed, becomes a recruitment of the already armed. Now, given that dynamic, you must first have an ongoing right of the people to keep and bear arms in order to quickly form the militia upon which that free state security is predicated. I mean, the reference to a regulated militia is a parenthetical rationale, not a contingency.
Well,
look,
it is
understanding,
regulated.
This is how
and
I'm going to...
For example... National Guard members, they have guns in their own homes. That's fine. They are part of a well-regulated militia. They don't let, for example, crazy people join the National Guard. If there's an individual right, then you would have to concede, Alan, that crazy people and violent felons and, I don't know, five-year-olds all can own guns, right? If it's an individual right, it has to apply to everybody.
No, because, just as the First Amendment can be said to not include the right to scream fire in a crowded theater, so it doesn't naturally follow that all of a sudden this is infringing on individual rights. You are setting parameters. But setting parameters is a very different thing than completely outlawing, which was the case in both D.C. and Chicago, or at least to an extent that might as well have been the same. See, my point is, though, understanding that the free state in question might have a population needing to protect itself from a potentially rogue local government. You got to remember, its affirmed free state entitlement would be endangered were the collective versus individual right to gun ownership prevail as the standard. I mean, it would subordinate citizens. Think about it. It would subordinate citizens to the very threat against which they might theoretically have to fight in order to keep their freedom inviolate. You know, Mark, what you're forgetting is that the anti-federalists were the ones who made accepting the Constitution contingent upon the Federalists' promise to add the Bill of Rights soon after, lest the central government have disproportionate power over individual liberty. So it would have been counterintuitive to have this one right entangled in a collective criteria that leaves it ripe for local government interference, while each and every one of the other nine remaining rights in the Bill of Rights was unquestionably individual. How do you get out of that?
Well, they are unquestionably individual. There are also plural rights right here there's the right of the people to be secure in their houses. There are other Congress shall make law respecting the status of religion. That's the right of the people. That's a general right, the right of the people to petition their government. That's not an individual right. That's a collective right. So other collective rights there, but the heart of the issue is...
I don't know how one cancels rebellion. Out the other. I can see how... Well, Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, because you're the lawyer.
Yeah.
I can see how all individual rights can be part of a collective right, but that it wouldn't necessarily follow that all collective rights are individual rights. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yes.
That seems to be inconsistent.
Not at all. You can have collective rights you don't have as individual, right? You may not have an individual right to declare yourself a messiah and practice your own single religion that only applies to you, but you may still have a collective right to practice a religion. Right?
Here's where I think your argument falls apart a little bit. Now, looking at the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, what that means is that just because it may be a collective right doesn't mean that it's not also an individual right, because it's the individual being protected by this amendment in question, and he does not or she does not have to be at the mercy of whether or not a collective dynamic was instead applied.
But if you notice, the Fourth Amendment uses both people and persons. It is both a collective and an individual right. Whereas the First Amendment, the right of the people to assemble, it doesn't say the right of persons to assemble. That's a collective right.
But it seems like you're arguing a contrast where there is no difference. This is the mistake
You seem to believe this well-regulated militia clause is unnecessary. You seem to believe that the Second Amendment says the right of persons to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You think that whole first section, those whole first 15 words...
On the contrary, I define it for what I think it to be.
Being eloquent and talking about things that have no meaning...
No. I don't say it's irrelevant. I define it for what I believe it to be. It's the reference to a regulated militia is a parenthetical rationale, not a contingency.
Where else is there a parenthetical rationale in the Constitution? Where else does the Constitution say, you have an absolute right to do this, and we do that because this is a good thing?
Rife with them. You and I both know that they are rife. The Constitution is rife with them. You go through the Bill of Rights, and you find parenthetical clauses. You find parenthetical references.
But they always serve to define. They always serve to delimit. Every word has a meaning. I don't believe people pass useless legislation. I don't believe that people pass these words and they have no meaning. You want the Second Amendment to say the right of persons to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But that's not what
it says. On the contrary, I say words have meaning. And if you're going to use these words, what you say must have something to do with what they mean. And as I projected this thing to read, the Constitution was reflected in the Supreme Court's final decision on both counts. And I fortunately wrote about this before those rulings were rendered. So either I was lucky or I took Telepathy 101 at Clairvoyance University, one of the two. Anyway, always a blast to have you on board. Mark Levine, everybody. Check out his website, marklevineradio.com. You are with Battleline, Main Street Radio Network. I'm Alan Nathan.